I can't afford not to play this game. As far as I can see, there's only one way forward for me and Sarah, and this is my best shot at it. I think Peter and Anton are right, Ilya says, breaking into the uncomfortable silence. We don't need this job. It's too risky. Let's just do a few extra gigs instead. I fork a piece of steak into my mouth, chew it, and swallow. It's decided, then, I say, and pick up my water. We're done here. Tomorrow morning we fly home. I lie awake, listening and waiting, and at 4 in the morning I hear it. The quiet snick of the hotel room lock opening and the squeak of hinges as the door starts to move. I react instantaneously, my body moving like a coiled spring. In a blink of an eye, I have the intruder on his knees, immobilized in a chokehold as I crouch behind him, holding a gun to his temple. He's choking and writhing, trying to escape, but he doesn't have the leverage to either hit me or throw me off, and each blocking movement only depletes his air supply. "Who sent you?" I ask when his frantic struggles start to weaken. "Why are you here?" I loosen my hold just enough to let him have some air. He resumes fighting, so I tighten my arm again, cutting off his air supply completely. This time he only lasts a few seconds, and I loosen my grip just before he slips into unconsciousness. "Who sent you?" I repeat, and he finally sees the wisdom in cooperating.
"Novak," he chokes out hoarsely.
"Why?" I press, not letting go. I already know what he's going to say, but I want to hear it from him anyway.
"He wants to see you," the thug gasps out. "Just you, no one else."
I tighten my grip as if upset, but then I let go and stand up, simultaneously shoving him forward to sprawl face down on the floor. While he's sucking in air and struggling to get up on all fours, I turn on the light and put on my winter jacket and boots. The rest of the clothes I'm already wearing, as I was expecting just such a visit. "You win," I tell the thug when he glares at me, resentfully rubbing his throat as he clambers to his feet. "Lead the way." My gambit of staying at a hotel in Belgrade has paid off. It's time to see what Novak has up his sleeve. Chapter 18. Peter. A black limo is waiting for us by the hotel entrance, and when I climb inside, I see Novak there. "That wasn't very welcoming of you," he says when the thug climbs in next to us, still rubbing his throat and glaring at me like he wants to incinerate me on the spot. "Victor was merely conveying my polite invitation by breaking into my room in the middle of the night." The arms dealer shrugs. "He didn't want to knock and risk waking your colleagues in the neighboring rooms." "I see." I give him an icy smile. "Very thoughtful of Victor." Novak's answering smile matches mine. "I'm sure you weren't too discomfited, given your profession. Now, why don't we set aside the manner of my invitation and focus on the matter at hand?" "By all means." I lean back, stretching out my legs to cross them at the ankles. "Go right ahead." Novak studies me for a few long moments, then says bluntly, "I don't trust your men. I know you have a history with Esquerra, but they have no reason to cross him."
"Other than 100 million euros, you mean?"
"It is a lot of money," he allows. "But your team is not hurting for cash from what I hear. What was it that you said? A few extra gigs and you'll have your 100?
His lizard eyes gleam in the light of the street lamp. I keep a poker face, showing neither surprise nor dismay. It's easy, because I feel neither. I knew there was a solid chance we'd be overheard at that restaurant, and I played the odds, my every word calculated to bring about this precise outcome.
Why am I here, then? I ask, when Novak just continues to stare at me.
If you don't trust us or our motivations, why come to us? And why drag me out here tonight?
I didn't say I don't trust your motivations. His thin lips curve. I know the full story of your employment with Esquerra. You did your job well, saved his life, in fact,
And for that, you ended up on his shit list. Can't feel good, I'm sure. And now you have a chance to balance out the scales and make a little money in the process. I allow my shoulders to relax slightly, as if relieved. That's very insightful of you. Novak's expression doesn't change, but I feel his satisfaction. He undoubtedly prides himself on being a good judge of people, and right now he's congratulating himself on doing his due diligence and reaching the right conclusions. He might even know about my break with Kent after the incident with Sarah, possibly by bribing someone at the clinic to eavesdrop on my team while we stayed there. That would explain the auspicious timing of his offer. He acted as soon as he found out my last remaining link to Esquerra's organization was severed. Of course, if his due diligence is that thorough, he knows about Sarah, too. That worries me, but I'm hoping he buys the story Sarah is telling the FBI, that I got tired of her, that the scar on her forehead somehow made her less attractive to me. Certainly, what I did, letting her go and risking not being able to retrieve her, is not something a man in our world would do when he's still interested in the woman he abducted. My forced relationship with Sarah is not that unusual in Novak circles, but letting her go when I still want her is. This is why it's safer for her back home. If Novak knew how I truly felt about Sarah, he'd use her as leverage, and I can't allow that. So, he says, when the silence stretches into an uncomfortable minute, I take it you do want the job. I incline my head. I do. But it doesn't matter what I want. I'm still not going in blind. That's not how I operate, and as much as I want Esquerra dead, I'm not willing to commit suicide to make it happen. Novak studies me for another long minute, then says, All right. Here's what I'm willing to tell you at this point. The asset that I have in place can't be activated yet. It will take about 8 months for me to make the appropriate arrangements. A few things have to fall into place first. 8 months. Only my training enables me to keep my expression unchanged as my guts twist at the shock of his words. 8 months until I can resolve this. 8 agonizing months without Sarah. Novak nods. It might be a little sooner, but there's no guarantee of that. In any case, that gives you and your team plenty of time to figure out your plan of action. I swallow the rage bubbling up in my throat. There's no plan if we don't know the specifics of what we're planning for, I say evenly. Where is your asset? On Esquerra's compound or elsewhere? What is it exactly that you're expecting us to do that your asset can't do himself? If it's someone on the inside, why don't you have him carry out the job? I assume he has access to Esquerra. Not yet, but she will. Novak registers my involuntary blink of surprise with evident pleasure. Yes, that's another thing I'm willing to tell you, that my asset is a woman. She will have access to Esquerra, but neither the skills nor the inclination to carry out the task. However, she could be at the right place at a specific time, providing a distraction, disabling certain security measures, etc. The particulars of the help will have to wait until she's in place and can assess the situation, but rest assured, you will have someone on the inside. I stare at him, torn. This is still not enough information, but I have a strong feeling that if I walk away this time, Novak will not approach me again. Also, given what he's revealed thus far, it might be a bullet that finds me next, not one of Novak's goons. I'm not too worried about that possibility. I'm used to people gunning for me. But Sarah is vulnerable, and I can't risk Novak coming after her in lieu of me. It's unlikely, given the he's bored with me scenario she's painted for the FBI, but I can't chance it. So let me get this straight, I say, leaning forward. You will have a woman on the inside, but not much sooner than 8 months from now. She's not capable of getting her hands dirty herself, but she'll render some assistance facilitating our task. At his nod, I ask, why can't you get her in place sooner? What's going to change over the next 8 months?
You'll have to wait to learn that, Novak says.
As of this moment, there's still a chance I won't be able to place the asset as expected. If certain things don't unfold as they should, we might have to wait for another opportunity. That, or your team goes in unassisted. He looks at me expectantly, and I shake my head. No, that's not happening. Esquera has layers upon layers of security at his compound. I know, because I helped him install them. And yes, though I know what they are, I still can't get past them. They're designed to be impenetrable. The only way in is with assistance from the inside, and if you can't provide that... I shrug, showing my empty palms. Novak nods.
Right. I figured as much. So you understand the value of my asset. Once she's in place, Esquera will have a hole in his security. However, it will take time.
There is no way to accelerate this process. I figure I know the answer, but I still have to ask.
No. I've tried to get to others on the inside, but they're all too loyal. Or too afraid of Esquera. This is the only one that shows promise. However, the timing is what it is.
I digest that for a moment, then ask, so why approach me now? Why not wait until you have the asset in place?
Because if you're not on board, I need to make alternate arrangements. And it takes time to find a skilled team and vet them. And in this particular case, with Esquera's reputation, well, I'm sure you know how it is.
Right. Even with the incentive of 100 million euros, few people would be willing to cross someone as dangerous as Julian Esquera. Almost everyone has something to lose, and Esquera has no mercy when it comes to his enemies. I know because I helped him decimate those who crossed him, wiping out entire communities in the process. The Colombian arms dealer doesn't distinguish between the innocent and the guilty. Everyone connected to his enemies pays.
So,
Novak leans forward, his pale gaze intent on my face.
Can I count on you and your team when the time comes?
I consider that for a moment and nod. Yes, you can. My tone is steady, though inside I'm still reeling. My separation from Sarah was supposed to last a couple of weeks, a couple of months at most. Not the better portion of a year. It's possible, of course, that what I need will come about meaningfully sooner than 8 months, but right now it doesn't sound likely. Novak won't disclose the identity of his asset any sooner than he has to.
Good.
His thin-lipped smile oozes satisfaction.
I was hoping I had the right man, and it sounds like I do. Just one more thing.
I lift an eyebrow. Yes?
I hope you understand that the information I shared with you today is highly sensitive, and for your ears only. That means not sharing with anyone on your team.
I was expecting that much after his preamble, so I nod. Understood. And on our end, we'll require a deposit. Usually it's half up front, but given the extended timing, we can accept 25 mil now, and another 25 closer to the job itself. Novak doesn't bat an eye.
You'll have the money in your account tomorrow.
We shake hands, and as we do, I try to ignore the agonizing void expanding in my chest at the thought of the months ahead. Now that I've embarked on this path, there's no choice, not really. I have to do this. This is the only way forward. If I want Sarah for the long term, I have to give her the life she deserves.
Part 2. Chapter 19. Sarah. The rest of November passes in a blur of hospital visits, random FBI interrogations, and waiting. Endless waiting. I feel like I'm constantly on edge, waiting for Peter to show up. Each time I cross the hospital parking lot, walk down the street, or fall asleep in my old bedroom at my parents' house. My house, by virtue of belonging to a wanted criminal, has been seized by the government. I expect to be snatched up and carried away. If not by Peter, then by one of the men he hired to watch me. And they are watching me. I know it. I feel it. It's the same itchy feeling as before. The same paranoia-inducing sensation of hidden eyes following me. Some of it is due to the FBI agents stalking my every move. But not all. I've gotten good at spotting the feds. It's always the nondescript car across the street. The pedestrian who doesn't quite belong. The lone man or woman at the bar. Peter's men are different. I never see them. I just feel their presence. They're the shadow around the corner. The echo of footsteps in the parking lot. The itch between my shoulder blades. They're there all the time, but never close enough for me, or the feds, to spot them. Of course, it's possible I really am paranoid this time, but I don't think so. I know Peter. He wouldn't leave me here without keeping tabs on me. Or so I keep telling myself, as week after week passes by without a word from him, without so much as a hint that he's coming back for me. I try to focus on the fact that I get to spend all this time with my parents, and I'm glad about that. I really am. Dad seems to have gotten a new lease on life since my return, swimming and doing his doctor-assigned exercises with renewed vigor and dedication. And Mom is getting better every day, her bones healing with the speed of a woman half her age. She's still bedbound for now, a fact that drives her insane. But the doctors promised that she'll start physical therapy as soon as her body can take it, possibly by the middle of January. November rolls into December, and still, the interminable waiting continues. It's like I exist in a limbo between my old life and the one I'd started to settle into with Peter. I'm living in my childhood home, surrounded by my family and friends. Yet I can't shake the sensation that I'm a guest, a visitor at a place I no longer belong. I think my parents sense that, because as December advances, they start questioning why I'm not doing certain things, like looking for a new job or finding another place to live. I fend them off by saying that I want to focus on Mom for now, but as her health continues to improve, that excuse sounds increasingly hollow. "Sarah, honey, you don't have to be here all the time," Mom says, when I come to visit her one chilly December morning. "Your dad can entertain me just as well, and I know you have things you've been putting off because of this." She waves her uninjured hand at the leg casts that keep her immobile. Smiling, I shake my head. "There's nothing that can't wait, Mom. Thanks to the sale of the house, I have money in the bank, and I like living with Dad. Unless he's tired of having me underfoot?" "Of course not," Mom says right away, as I knew she would. "He loves having you back home. You have no idea what a relief it is to have you back. If you want to live with us forever, you are more than welcome. I just know that you've always been independent, and I don't want you to feel obligated to take care of us, instead of getting your life back on track." Life back on track. I bite back the urge to tell her that I don't know what that means anymore. That there's no track for me. No straightforward path that I can see. My future, once so clear and linear, is now shrouded in darkness, full of twists I can only guess at. "Don't worry, Mom," I say, shaking off the gloomy thought. "I'm happy to be here with you and Dad." And smiling, I gently steer the conversation away from me. Away from the future I can no longer envision. We celebrate Hanukkah at the Levinsons, then Christmas and New Year's at the hospital with Mom. At the celebrations, I laugh and smile, exchange gifts, and pretend I'm back for good. I tell my dad that, yes, I will look for a new job soon, and I discuss the purchase of a new house with Joe Levinson. He recommends a good real estate agent to me, and I write down the name, as though it matters. As though any of it matters, when at any moment, I might disappear again. By the time mid-January rolls around, the strain of waiting and pretending, of constantly juggling all the half-truths and lies, takes its toll on me. Peter's absence is a raw gash in my heart, and no matter how hard I try to focus on my family and friends, I miss him all the time, so much that he's all I can think about throughout the day. I know how wrong that is, and I kick myself for it, but at this point, I'm so used to the smothering guilt that it doesn't feel as awful as it once did. Wanting my tormentor doesn't feel as heavy of a betrayal. I still can't forget that Peter killed George and held me captive for months, or that he murders people for money. But when I think about him, it's the sweet, tender moments that come to mind. All the little ways he demonstrated daily how much he cares. I catch myself daydreaming about how he'd rub my feet and bring me breakfast in bed, how he'd take care of me when I wasn't feeling well, how I'd fall asleep in his arms instead of my cold, empty bed. The nights are definitely the worst. That's when my longing for him is most acute, my need crossing over into the physical. Every evening, I toss and turn, struggling to fall asleep while my body burns for a man who's thousands of miles away. I try playing with toys, reading erotic stories, even watching porn, but nothing quenches that aching emptiness inside me. It's like that time when Peter was away on his Mexico gig, only 1,000 times worse, because back then, at the very beginning of our strange relationship, he was still a terrifying stranger. Now, however, he's a part of me, having wedged himself into my heart and mind to the point that life without him feels as empty as my bed. It's so bad that I consider giving in to my parents' urgings and actually looking for another job. Instead, however, I decide to go back to volunteering at the women's clinic. To my relief, they are more than happy to have me back. "We missed you so much," Lydia, the receptionist, tells me. "We didn't even realize how much we needed you until you were gone. Is everything okay now? The FBI showed up, questioning all of us, and..." "Yes, everything is fine. It was just a misunderstanding about the guy I went on vacation with," I say, not wanting to do the whole song and dance here as well. "It's all resolved now. Don't worry." I can tell that Lydia is dying of curiosity, but she holds her tongue, sensing my reluctance to discuss things further. I have no idea what rumors were going around here, but luckily for me, the clinic staff and volunteers deal with sensitive situations all the time, and they know when to pry and when to leave things alone. After one round of "What happened?" and "Where have you been?" everyone leaves me to focus on the patients, which I do full-time and then some. Basically, whenever I'm not with my parents. "How the hell are you managing to overwork yourself while unemployed?" Marcia complains a month later, when I call to decline her invitation to go out yet again, claiming exhaustion from a night shift at the clinic. "Seriously, hon, I haven't seen you outside of the hospital hallways in weeks. First, it was your mom who needed you 24/7. Now it's this. We haven't hung out at all after that one time at Patty's." "I know, I know." I sigh into the phone, pinching the bridge of my nose. "I'm sorry, Marcia. Maybe next week will be easier." "It won't be. I'm on schedule at the clinic for over 60 hours next week, including 2 night shifts. But I will make time for Marcia regardless. I've been avoiding her after learning about her involvement with the FBI, and I'm starting to feel bad about that. What she did felt like a betrayal, but that's not an entirely rational reaction. She was probably doing what she thought was best, maybe even imagined she was helping me. In any case, cooperating with the feds is generally the right strategy for the average law-abiding citizen, which is something I can no longer consider myself to be. Not when I'm concealing my true feelings about a wanted killer. I think Agent Ryson senses that I'm not telling the full truth, because he keeps dragging me into the FBI office downtown. At this point, I've endured at least 10 interrogations, and each time I've stuck to my story, telling the agents only what I disclosed in the beginning, and nothing more. It helps that whenever they start probing deeper, my heart rate jumps, and my body goes into a full-blown panic attack mode. It's like my PTSD or whatever is on Peter's side.
"Are you seeing a therapist, Dr. Kabakas?" Ryson asks, after they have to bring Karen, their agent with medical training, to calm me down after a particularly thorough questioning session.
"If not, I can recommend someone."
My breathing is still shallow and unsteady from the panic attack, but I manage to shake my head. "I have someone, thanks." I haven't seen my therapist, Dr. Evans, since my return, but he's good. He helped me before, when I couldn't cope with the nightmares and anxiety resulting from Peter's attack in my kitchen. I should go see him again, but I can't bring myself to walk into his office and feed him the same confusing mix of truth and lies I've been regurgitating for the FBI. I'd rather deal with my issues on my own while I wait for Peter. He'll be back for me any day.
Chapter 20. Peter. I count the days on a calendar, marking them down like a man waiting to get out of prison. My liberation day, the day when I'll be reunited with Sarah, can only be guesstimated, so I pick a date 8 months from my meeting with Novak and count down to that, because finding out the specifics of Novak's asset is step one toward my plan of ensuring a real future with Sarah. With our Japan hideout presumed compromised, we go from safe house to safe house, never staying in one place for longer than a couple of weeks. Along the way, we do various jobs, some more challenging than others, but none as complicated or dangerous as the one we agreed to with Novak. My teammates, even Jan, accepted my decision to take the Esquera hit, as well as the fact that we will find out more about the asset when the time is right. As I promised Novak, I didn't tell him any of the details we discussed. Partially, that's because there's really nothing to talk about yet, but mainly it's because I need Novak to trust me. My guys can act as well as anyone in Hollywood, but when dealing with someone of Novak's vast resources, one never knows who's listening and when. Our safe houses are secure, but we do venture out, and a parabolic mic can be used from surprising distances. That, more than anything, is why Sarah is no longer a topic of conversation among us. As far as anyone on my team is concerned, she might as well not exist. I don't want to hear her name or even the pronoun she, I told them. Don't mention her to me and don't ever discuss her among yourselves. She's gone and that's that. Got it? They all nodded, understanding my concern, and I added more layers of security to my communication with the hackers and the men we hired to watch Sarah in the U.S. I can't not watch my Petichka, but for her safety nobody can know of my continued obsession with her. And I am obsessed. It's a sickness made worse by her absence. I dream about Sarah every night. Sometimes it's about something as innocuous as holding her and brushing her silky hair, but often the dreams are dark and violent. In some, I'm losing her. In others, I'm the cause of her pain. Our first meeting where I drugged and waterboarded her has been haunting me in recent weeks. The recollections invading my mind in exquisitely brutal detail. Worst of all, I wake up from the dreams of hurting her with my cock hard and aching, and I know that as much as I miss her, as much as I love her with all my heart, my feelings for Sarah will never be simple and sweet, untainted by the darkness of our past, by the things I've done to her, and may do again. If the nights are bad, the days are even worse. The first thing I do every morning is go over the reports on Sarah, both from the hackers and the Americans watching her. That's how I know that she's gone back to volunteering at the clinic and that her mother has started physical therapy. Occasionally, the Americans manage to get a long-distance video of Sarah as well, and on those days, I watch the recording several times before breakfast and then a dozen more times in the evening right before I fall asleep. In between, I train my team and run the business, but my mind is not on any of it. It's on her, my beautiful Petichka, whom I miss like a severed limb. I think about retrieving her constantly. Thanks to Sarah's story about me getting bored with her, the feds haven't tried to hide her from me. They still watch her in case I return, but they haven't deemed it necessary to put her in the witness protection program or anything along those lines. I think it's because they're hoping I'll return for her. She's bait, though they won't admit it. And I'm tempted. Fuck am I tempted. Now that her parents no longer need her as much, I fantasize about getting her back daily, to the point that the whole operation is mapped out in my mind. I know exactly how we'd bypass the air controls and where we'd land,
how we'd create a distraction to lure the feds away from Sarah, and how we'd plant a false trail to throw them off our scent while we escape. We could do it tomorrow, if we were so inclined. Some 20 hours from now, I could be holding Sarah. Most of the time I can shake off the fantasy, reiterating to myself the reasons why I'm doing this, reminding myself that she's safer where she is. However, there are days when the fantasy is all I can think about, and I catch myself seconds from giving in and ordering Anton to prep the plane. To maintain my sanity, I intensify the search for Henderson, the last and most elusive person on my list. The fact that we haven't already found him and his family substantiates the rumor about his CIA background. The fucker is good at this, as good as someone in my profession. It may be time to turn up the heat. We're going to North Carolina, I announce at the breakfast table the following morning. Going to shake things up in Asheville, see if we can flush the fucker out the hard way. My teammates look up from their plates with identically unsurprised expressions. This has been the fallback plan all along. We'd rather not involve innocents, Henderson's friends and distant family members who had nothing to do with the Darjevo massacre, but given our target's elusiveness, it's the only option left. He'll be expecting us, Anton says, pushing his plate aside. It's most likely a trap. I smile grimly. I know. The difficulty of this operation is what I'm looking forward to the most. Not only will we have to get in and out of the country undetected, but Henderson will undoubtedly have the feds keeping an eye on his connections. Logistically, this will be similar to stealing Sarah back, only instead of kidnapping one woman, we'll be interrogating half a dozen people, all of whom are likely watched by Henderson's buddies from the FBI and maybe even the CIA. Should be fun, Jan says, his green eyes gleaming. Beats sticking around here. He waves his hand to indicate the rustic cabin where we've been staying for the past week, our safe house in eastern Poland. Ilya shoots him a glare and resumes eating. He's been on the outs with his brother for the past week, ever since Jan fucked a Budapest waitress Ilya also wanted. It's not the first time the situation has arisen. The twins have a similar taste in women. But in the past, they would just amicably share, either by double-teaming the girl or taking turns. I have no idea what made this waitress different, but Ilya has been pissed with Jan ever since we got here. I'm not about to get into the middle of that dispute, so I just pretend not to notice the tension at the table. Get ready, I tell the guys. I want to be in Asheville before the end of the week, so we need to have a viable plan by tomorrow. And getting up, I go to email my U.S. contacts.
Chapter 21. Sarah. I meet Marcia at a club in the West Loop neighborhood of Chicago. It's new, trendy, and so loud, my ears throb from the music blaring from the speakers. Marcia is already on the dance floor, grinding against two young banker types. So I make my way to the bar and order myself a gin and tonic. I'm hoping the alcohol will soothe the ever-present ball of tension in my stomach. Any day now. Any day. I've been telling myself this for weeks. Yet I'm still here, still in this unsettling limbo. 5 days ago, Mom walked the entire distance from her bed to the bathroom with only her crutches for assistance. And yet I'm still here, living in my parents' house with no idea when, or if, Peter is coming back for me. Could it be? Could the lies I've been telling the FBI have turned out to be the truth? Maybe my Russian assassin did get bored with me. Maybe my clinging to him at the clinic made him lose interest. I know he thrives on danger and challenges of all sorts, and maybe that's all I meant to him. A challenge. After all, what greater achievement is there than winning the affection of your enemy's widow, a woman who has every reason to hate your guts? The thought keeps invading my mind, and I keep pushing it away, remembering the look on Peter's face when he vowed to return for me. As long as there's breath in my body, he said, and I didn't doubt him for a moment. Not after the lengths he went to in order to make me his. I still don't doubt him. Not really. And that means only one thing. If Peter hasn't returned for me, it's because he can't. It's because something happened. I've been trying not to think about that, to force the terrifying possibility from my mind, but I can no longer ignore it. Peter's life is such that he might as well be a soldier in a war zone. Between the authorities hunting him worldwide, and the powerful criminals he deals with all the time, he defies the odds just surviving from day to day. And when his jobs are added to the mix, the chances that he's hurt, or worse, are not insignificant. In fact, they're so high, my insides are in a permanent knot these days. The only thing that gives me solace is that I'm still being watched, both by the FBI and by Peter's shadowy men. The itchy feeling between my shoulder blades never abates when I'm in public. In fact, at this very moment, I'm certain there are at least a couple of my stalkers in the club. The nondescript Fed who followed me in and is nursing a beer on the other side of the bar. And someone else. Someone I can't identify, but whose presence I feel. If Peter was dead or captured, and the FBI knew it, they'd stop following me around. Same goes for whoever Peter hired. It's not much of a relief. He could still be badly hurt somewhere. But it's something. It's what lets me get up every morning and go about my day, despite the gnawing pit in my stomach. There you are. Marcia pops up next to me, beaming with that unique glow that only alcohol-enhanced dancing generates. I was beginning to think you wouldn't show. I'm here, I assure her, as the bartender hands me my drink. Just got delayed at the clinic. You know how that goes. She nods sympathetically and tells the bartender, "A Corona, please." He hands her the bottle, and she clinks it against my glass. "To finally getting you out," she says, and I laugh as my friend takes a long sip. "So," she says, "how have you been? I can't believe March is around the corner, and we haven't hung out since your first week back." "Ugh, I know." I make a face. "Sorry about that. It's just that with my mom and everything..." Marcia cuts me off with a wave of her beer. "Say no more. I get it. I do. Just tell me one thing." She looks around, then leans closer, laying a hand on my forearm. "Are you okay, hon?" Her voice is soft, despite the blaring music, her gaze lingering on the now faded scar on my forehead. "We never really talked about, well, what happened." My throat tightens. "I told you what happened." She nods gravely. "I know. I'm not talking about that. How are you handling it?" "I'm stressed to the max, unable to eat or sleep, having nightmares about Peter hurt or dead." "Fine." "Uh-huh." Marcia glances down at my forearm, which looks particularly skinny and pale under her tan, sleekly manicured fingers. "That's why you're imitating an anatomy lab skeleton." I pull my arm away. "I'm on a diet." She sighs and leans back. "I see." I sip my drink, wishing I could tell her the truth, that I'm not suffering from psychological trauma, but missing the man who did this to me. That I'm waiting for him to return and reclaim me. Except, if I say that, I might as well sign my own jail sentence. "I'm fine," I repeat. Putting on a bright smile, I say, "How about we stop talking about depressing stuff and just go dance?" Marcia hesitates, then grins. "All right, dance it is." I grab her hand, and we make our way to the crowded dance floor. They're just starting to play one of Nicki Minaj's latest hits, and I laugh as I remember belting out my own version of this song to the guys back in Japan. Marcia laughs too, tilting her head back to gulp her beer, and we start dancing. I sing along, substituting some of my own lyrics at key spots, and before long, we're genuinely having fun. The beat vibrates through my bones, making my feet move of their own accord. And I giggle as some of my drink spills on my hand. "Hold on," I tell Marcia, and down the rest of my gin and tonic to avoid another accident. Setting the empty glass on a nearby table, I push my way through the crowd to the bar and order a bottle of beer, much more dance floor friendly. By the time I return, Marcia is already dancing with a couple of new guys, and as I approach, she grabs my hand, pulling me toward them. "This is Bill and Rob," she shouts over the loud music, and I smile uncomfortably. This is not what I had in mind when I agreed to this outing with Marcia. "I'm going to go use the restroom," I say, leaning in so Marcia can hear. "I'll be back soon." "Wait, I'll come with you." Marcia abandons her companions without a second look and follows me through the crowd. It's still early in the night, so the line to the ladies' room isn't too bad. As we wait, Marcia tells me all about the club she went to with Tanya last weekend and the hot guy she met there. I listen, smile, and nod, marveling the entire time at how different my friend's life is, how straightforward and uncomplicated. When was the last time my biggest concern was whether a guy is likely to call me? College, maybe? When I met George, my dating life ground to a halt, and I didn't resume it after his death. Peter claimed me before I got the chance. We finally make it to the bathroom, take care of business, and then return to the dance floor. It's even more crowded now, so after a half hour of being shoved around and having drinks spilled on us, Marcia yells in my ear, "Let's get out of here." I gratefully follow her out, and we go to a lounge a couple of blocks down the street, where we plop down at the bar and listen to a live band playing 80s rock songs, interspersed with recent top 100 hits. "You sing, right?" Marcia asks, after we knock back a couple of shots, and I nod, my head spinning from the alcohol. "All right, then," Marcia grins. "Let's do this." She hops off the bar stool and grabs my wrist, raising my arm in the air. "Hey, everyone," she shouts over the music. "My friend here can belt out a mean one. You all want to hear?" I want to sing through the floor, but a few people in the crowd, mostly tipsy dudes, respond with a chorus of, "Hell yes! Come on!" Marcia all but pushes me onto the stage, where the band members look less than pleased to be dealing with an amateur. Normally, I would slink away and yell at Marcia later, but between the alcohol loosening my inhibitions and my little performances for Peter and his men in Japan, I somehow find the courage to remain on the stage. "Do you guys know Karma by Alicia Keys?" I ask the guitarist, hoping I'm not slurring my words. The guitarist, a ruddy-cheeked guy with a receding hairline, gives me a wary look. "Maybe. You going to sing as we play?" "Do you mind?" I give him my prettiest smile. "Just one song, and I'll be out of your hair." He exchanges a look with the other musicians, then shoves a mic into my hands and says, "Oh, what the hell. Go for it, girl. Show us what you got." They play the first few notes, and I turn to face the crowd, my pulse quickening as I realize what I've gotten myself into. The last time I performed in front of so many people was back in middle school, when I got a lead role in a school musical. And just like then, I feel a swarm of butterflies in my stomach, a jittery kind of excitement. "Use it," I tell myself, and taking a deep breath, I begin to sing, letting my own lyrics mix with the familiar words of the song. Despite all the drinks, my voice comes out strong and pure, so powerful I can feel the vibration of the sound. All the other noise in the lounge dies down, and I see both surprise and wonder on the faces looking up at me, including that of the undercover Fed, who followed us from the club and is now nursing a drink in the corner. Marcia looks amazed too, and I realize she's never actually heard me sing on my own. We've done the happy birthday song for a couple of nurses as a group, and she probably heard me sing along with the DJ's selection at that club outing a few months back, but never like this. Never as a performance, especially with my own lyrics. I almost choke up at that thought. I've never shared my lyrics with anyone but Peter and his team. However, I manage to keep going, and as I sing my version of the chorus, I notice people in the audience starting to sing along, slapping their palms on the tables and tapping their feet to the beat. The butterflies inside me expand, filling every crevice in my chest until I feel like I will float away on their beating wings. And I keep singing, as my body starts to follow the music, my dancing training coming to the forefront. I'm not conscious of feeling like I'm soaring until the song ends, and thunderous applause erupts. Coming off the high, I see Marcia clapping and hooting madly at the front, and I beam as I turn around, wanting to thank the band. Except they're clapping too, and it feels like a fantasy, like something my adolescent self might have conjured in a daydream. That was incredible. Do you have more songs like that? The guitarist asks, and I nod, though the butterflies are now more like hummingbirds in my chest. In Japan, I composed and recorded dozens of songs, some to existing music, others to my own mixes, and I performed them for my captors as part of our evening ritual. Peter always told me I'm good, but I chalked it up to flattery and a lack of other entertainment. These people, however, are complete strangers. There's no reason for them to flatter me. If anything, the musicians should shoo me off the stage so they can get back to real music. I have this one other one, I tell the guitarist breathlessly, when the fantasy shows no signs of dissolving. Do you know the tune to Bruno Mars's Just the Way You Are? He grins. Sure do. All right, let's do it. What's your name? Sarah, I say, and instantly regret it. My name is beyond ordinary, and this night deserves something else. Something like Madonna, or Rihanna, or SZA. Let's get a round of applause for Sarah, the guitarist shouts, and I forget all about my ordinary name as the people in the audience clap and hoot. The band starts playing Just the Way You Are, and I take a deep breath to prepare myself. As it gets to the words, I again use my own lyrics, and the soaring feeling returns as I see the reaction of the audience. They're loving it. They're genuinely loving it. All too soon, the song is over, and I crash back down to earth, only to soar again as the audience demands one more song, then another, and another. I perform 7 of my best numbers in a row, and then my voice starts to give out. That's it, I tell the band, handing the mic back to the guitarist. Thank you so much for indulging me. Girl, you can sing with us anytime, he says. In fact, he turns around, locks eyes with his bandmates, then turns back to face me. We'll be performing here all weekend, and we'd love it if you joined us. Oh, we'd obviously split the earnings with you, he says, as though I was about to refuse out of monetary consideration. It's a pretty sweet gig here. You guys can't afford her, Marcia says, and I turn to see her coming up on the stage, hips swaying. She's a doctor, you know. For real? The guitarist gives me a once-over. Talented, pretty, and smart, huh? I flush as Marcia says, You bet. So if you want to book her, you gotta talk to me first. Here. She grabs his wrist, pulls out a pen, and scribbles her number on his forearm, right next to a tattoo of a heart pierced with an arrow. Winking, she adds, I'm available anytime. I laugh, realizing what Marcia is doing, and tug her off the stage before my friend starts making out with the musician right then and there. According to the rumors at the hospital, she's done crazier things when drunk. We push our way through the still-clapping audience and burst outside, the frigid February air doing little to cool our excitement. I'm still buzzing from the alcohol and the performance high, and Marcia is excited as well, laughing and chattering about what just happened and how she can be my agent so we can both be rich if I make it big. We're having so much fun, I forget for a moment that none of this is real, that my life right now is just one big waiting game. However, when I get into a cab to go home, I remember, and my high fades without a trace. While I was out singing and getting drunk, another evening passed. Another day ended without Peter returning.
Chapter 22, Peter. I think about contacting Sarah as we land at a small private airport in the foothills of the Great Smoky Mountains, some 90 kilometers from Asheville and only a few states away from her. It's beyond tempting to pick up the phone and call her, so I can hear her voice. But if I did that, the feds, who are still watching her and listening to her calls, would be all over her, once again doubting her story and putting her through the ringer. It's not the first time I've considered reaching out to her. I think about it all the time. As careful as the feds are, I could still get one of the men I hired to watch her to surreptitiously pass her a letter. It would be risky, but I could do it. What stops me are not the logistics, but that I'm not sure what I would say, and what Sarah's reaction would be to getting such a letter. As much as I'd like to think that she misses me as much as I miss her, I know there's a very real possibility that the fragile accord we built toward the end of her captivity is gone, that being back home has made her hate and fear me again. She might be hoping I'm gone for good, and getting my letter would upset her. Besides, what can I tell her about why I'm staying away? I can't disclose anything about Novak and Esquerra, too dangerous if the letter got intercepted, so that leaves me with basic assurances that I'm still alive and coming for her. Assurances that she could easily interpret as a threat if she's happy to be home without me. I can tell that my guys are dying to say something about the situation, but the rule about no Sarah talk remains in place, and they know better than to break it. So they keep quiet, and I focus on getting through the days without Sarah, relying on the daily reports about her to feed my obsession. A couple of days ago, she went out with her friend, Marcia, and ended up singing at a lounge, performing one of her songs in public. Just reading about that filled my chest with a warm glow, and I instructed the Americans to record her the next time, so I could listen to her and watch the reaction of the audience. I feel absurdly proud at the thought of my little songbird putting herself out there like this, shaking off her inhibitions and displaying the talent that I've always known was there. Of course, pride wasn't my only reaction to that report. The idea of her going out to places where other men might hit on her is like a burning coal in my side. Sarah is mine. The physical distance between us doesn't change that fact. So far, the reports haven't indicated anyone seriously sniffing around her, but that doesn't mean it hasn't happened. With the FBI constantly tailing Sarah, my men have to be extra careful, and there are times they simply can't get close enough to make sure some asshole isn't begging her for a phone number or offering to buy her coffee. If I could have a listening device on Sarah herself, I'd do it in a heartbeat. I'd plant a chip inside her brain if I could. "You ready?" Jan says, and I realize I've been mindlessly cleaning my gun for the past minute instead of grabbing my bag and getting off the plane. "Yeah," I say, reassembling the gun and stuffing it into my waistband. "Let's do this." Lyle Bolton, Wally Henderson's first cousin, owns a small organic grocery store in Asheville. As far as his friends and neighbors are concerned, he's a kind, peaceful man, with the requisite 2.5 kids, two preschoolers and a baby on the way. His pregnant wife is a stay-at-home mom, and to the outsiders, they seem like the perfect suburban couple. Too bad none of them know what our hackers have uncovered. We wait for him in the Hooker's mountain cabin, our SUV parked out of sight behind the shed. Technically, the girl is an escort, but sex for money is all the same as far as I'm concerned. Bolton comes here every Tuesday and Thursday on his way back from the local farms where he gets produce for the store. His wife is completely clueless, and so is everyone else in the community. Nobody would imagine that the quiet, church-going Mr. Bolton, who's passionate about animal welfare and the environment, would pay a barely legal escort to let him defecate on her twice a week after he beats her up. Henderson has his buddies keeping tabs on Bolton's home and work, which is why this cabin is a perfect place to question the fucker. His dirty little habit is a secret from everyone, his cousin included, and thanks to all the precautions he's taken to account for this stretch of time, nobody will come looking for him until he doesn't show up at the store some 4 hours later. We can do a lot in 4 hours. The cabin is empty except for us. Jan lured the hooker away this morning by pretending to be a high-paying client. Once he got her into a hotel room, he tied her up and left her there. If we have time, he'll untie her later today. If not, housekeeping will find her tomorrow morning. Either way, the girl is not going to go to the cops, especially once she finds the payment on the nightstand. Lyle Bolton is prompt, as usual, showing up at 9:45. His truck rambles into the gravel driveway, and I motion to the guys to get ready. Nabbing our prey is child's play. He has no idea what's in store for him. The fucker walks in with a big, shit-eating grin on his chubby face, and Ilya steps out from behind the door and punches him in the stomach. He does it lightly as someone that massive can, but Bolton still flops over on all fours, gasping and wheezing and trying to scramble away. Jan kicks him in the ribs, and then I step in, pulling up the fucker by the back of his shirt as he starts to blubber and plead for mercy. "Your cousin," I say calmly, depositing him into a kitchen chair. "Where is he?" He gapes at us, and I see a new kind of fear on his face. He realizes now this is not a mistake, that we're not burglars who just happened to be here.
I don't know,
he stutters out, and I sigh before pulling out my gun. "One more chance," I say, putting the barrel to his forehead. "Where the fuck is Wally?" He pisses himself. A dark stain spreads over the crotch of his corduroys, and I smell the acrid stench of urine. It annoys me nearly as much as the tears and snot running down his face.
"I swear to you, I don't know,"
he wails, and I lower the gun, squeezing the trigger twice in rapid succession. His screams are deafening as he falls off the chair and rolls into a lethal ball on the floor. I just planted 2 bullets, one in each foot, and I wait a minute for the screams to die down before repeating, "Where is your fucking cousin?"
"I don't know, don't know, don't know."
He's hysterical now, holding his bleeding feet with both hands.
"Please, I swear, I don't know. He disappeared over 2 years ago, and I haven't heard anything since."
"Nothing? No calls, no emails, no letters?" I already know the answer to that thanks to our hackers, so I'm not surprised when the blubbering idiot shakes his head like a wound-up toy.
"No, no, I swear, nothing. No one's heard from him since he left."
I turn to Jan. "What do you think?" I ask in Russian. "You believe this piece of shit?" He studies him, then nods.
"Yeah, I think so. Henderson's too careful to reach out to this one."
"Okay, then. Let's go." Bending down, I take Bolton's phone from his pocket and leave him to blubber and bleed on the floor as we walk out of the cabin. Before we leave, I disable his vehicle to make sure he can't leave for a while. We have 5 more assholes to interrogate before this one's fate is discovered. Chapter 23, Peter. The next 2 people on our list pose about as much challenge as Bolton. The first, Ian Wiles, is a retired schoolteacher who's Henderson's uncle twice removed. The two of them used to exchange emails on a regular basis before Henderson's disappearance, and it's possible that Henderson might still keep in touch with him somehow. However, the minute we nab the old man on his way home from the post office, it becomes obvious he doesn't know anything. He's so fucking clueless and stunned by our questions that we don't even bother roughing him up. We just tie him up and leave him with his disabled vehicle in the woods, where he'll be found in a few hours when his wife comes home and discovers him missing. The second person, Jennifer Lowe's, is Henderson's wife's friend. A plump, middle-aged woman, she literally shits herself when we grab her outside her parents' nursing home. Within the first minute of our interrogation, it becomes clear that she's clueless as well, and we leave her tied behind a dumpster in an alley, gagged and terrified out of her wits, but otherwise unharmed. 0 for 3, Anton remarks as we peel out of the alley, but I just shrug. This is not unexpected. If Henderson kept in touch with these people, we would have likely uncovered it by now. Also, the security around them would have been tighter. The fact that they were relatively easy to get to tells me they're not in Henderson's inner circle. The people who matter to him, his wife and children, are as well hidden as any treasure. In any case, getting information about Henderson's whereabouts is not our primary goal.
This is about sending a message, telling him that no one in his life, no matter how distant a connection, is safe.